still trying to turn my phone up. I'm technologically challenged. Look at that. I spilled a little bit of coffee. I never did that with alcohol. I could fall down a flight of stairs with a drink in my hand, and that wrist would spin, you know? Yeah. Anyhow, like I said, I'm an alcoholic. I don't mean maybe. I'm convinced of my innermost self. I started drinking when I was about 12 years old. I was raised in, I was raised by my parents in New York City, but I think I was lowered by them. My dad was a longshoreman, big, burly dude, you know, and he was a drinker. Now, it's not my place to say he was an alcoholic, but, you know, he's stopped to it since then. I tried to act surprised. And when he drank, he was very unpredictable. When he didn't drink, when he was sober, he was like the nicest guy. Just the nicest guy in the world, you know. And when he was drunk, he was just unpredictable. And the rules were always changing in my house, you know. And it was always chaotic. And we're pretty severely abused physically, you know. People, you know, you could say, well, it was different back then, you know, and people got spanked. I didn't get spanked. I got beat up like I was a grown man when I was a little kid, you know, because the alcohol impaired him to where he would do that, you know. And, I mean, here I'd be having a great time with my dad, you know, earlier in the evening, and then, like, you know, have to go to the emergency room and get 7 stitches in my head later in the night. And I couldn't understand how somebody who loves you to do that to you. And there's something that was inside of me that decided I must be to blame for that. So what I did is I tried to overcompensate and be the best kid that ever lived, you know? I mean, I was the smartest kid in my school every year. I'd come home with, I went to Catholic school. I went to Our Lady of Perpetual Guilt in Brooklyn. And I'd get 100 on every test and 100 on everything I did. And the nuns would give me 99.9. They wouldn't give me 100. And I didn't particularly care about it. You know, I was thrilled. 99.9 average. All the teachers are fussing, you know. And, oh, well, you're so smart. And I'd run home my report card and show my parents 99.9 average. And they'd go, if you would have studied this much harder, you could have had 100. And so all of that happiness just like flowed right out of me, you know. I felt like I didn't have any sort of accomplishment there. I failed, you know. I failed. And I tried to, you know, I played baseball and I boxed and stuff like that too, you know. And I tried to be really good at it, you know. And but boy, if I struck out, I felt like I failed, you know. I just failed. Not that my father came to any of my games, but he would have heard about it. But anyway, so I grew up trying to get approval from the outside. And as many of you have probably found out by now, unless you're very recent arrivals in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it's an inside job, you know. It's an inside job, you know. I had to learn to approve of myself, but I had no training in that, you know. And so I always felt different. The kids in school, because I had the highest average in the school, they would say, ah, brown nose, teacher's pet, stuff like that. So they despised me for being smart, you know. And I knew that. So after school, I had to hang out with these kids, you know. This was the baby boom. 50 of them lived on my block, you know. And I had to hang out with them. So what I did is I'd act extra stupid outside. It was the beginning of my being an emotional chameleon, adjusting who I was to fit in with other people, you know. And so consequently, some of them came to think, oh, hey, no, he's all right, you know. He's all right. He's the smartest kid in school, but he'll still break the neighbor's window on purpose. You know, he's okay. But you know what? Even with all of them telling me I was okay, I didn't feel okay. Because something inside me knew that was not in harmony with who I was, although I didn't have the words for that yet, you know? And so I was never able to do anything perfectly. I was in spelling bees, and I got all the way to the Nationals in Washington, D.C., and 1 year I was the fourth best speller in the United States. Fourth best. I failed, you know? I remember my parents, you know, they went to Washington to watch the spelling bee. I got beat by three Chinese people. I still want to nuke that country. Unless you're Chinese, I'm only kidding. Do not meet me after the talk. And but you know, I remember driving home with them, and it was silence in the car all the way home. Nobody said, "Hey, you know, you still did good." Nobody said anything like that. It was just silence. And I sat in the back thinking, they're going to take me to a swamp in Jersey and dispose of my body. Because my father, when he was drunk, he would beat me up like really bad, and then tell me, "One of these days, mister, I'm going to kill you." And I believed him. I believed that one day he was going to kill me. And I was just messed up in my head. You know, I didn't understand life. I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere in the world, like, for who I really was. I could pretend and I could fit in with anybody. I could pretend I was something I wasn't and fit in with anybody, but who I was didn't match up, didn't measure up. And by the time I was 12 years old, I was suicidal. I really was. I just wanted to die. I had no interest in stretching out this sentence called life, you know? And then a remarkable thing happened. That summer, I met my first drug of choice. Her name was Diane Pahevitz. She told me I can break her anonymity. And it was my first love, my first little summer puppy love. And this girl, all we did was hold hands and kiss in the bushes and stuff like that. But man, she did everything for me that alcohol later did. She made me feel suave and sophisticated and important and well-liked and confident. And then one night I went to call for her, and some guy I didn't know answered the door, and he said, "Oh no, her family moved." And I was like, pull that arrow out of my heart, will you? And it hurt so bad, I didn't know what to do. And I always got over in my neighborhood, one of my favorite masks was being the funny guy, you know? I cracked everybody up, and they just accepted me for that. But that night, I could not keep my mask together. It was just crumbling right off my face. And my friend said to me, "What happened, man? What happened?" I said, my little lip was quivering, you know, "Diane's family moved." And I said, "Oh, you had your heart broken. You're a man now. You're a big 12-year-old man." So they went out and they bought me a pack of Marlboros, my good friend, and a quart of Schaefer beer. Which I don't know if they had Schaefer out here, but they had it back east, and the commercial used to say, "Schaefer is the one beer to have when you're having more than one," which was kind of a prophecy. Because I was having more than one. In fact, that night I had more than one. I drank that quart of beer, and my friends, I was so hilarious to them that they went and got me another one. And I didn't remember anything about what happened that night except only one thing, just one thing. That all the bad feelings went away like magic. However, when I woke up, my head was pounding. I was feeling like I had to throw up, just really ill. And all I could think of is, I can't wait to do that again, you know? And, you know, when I think about it, I was talking to my sister, and my sister was saying, "Well, you know, you had all that alcohol-type thinking and behavior way before that." I said, "What are you talking about?" She reminded me, I used to stand in front of my house with my arms out and spin, and spin, and spin, and spin, until I got so dizzy I fell down, and it would give me these excruciating headaches that would last for about 10 minutes, and then as soon as the headache wore off, I was up spinning again. I was willing to go through the pain to have that little respite, that little area of relief where I didn't have to feel things. And I hung out in the parks in New York City, and that was a very popular thing to do back then. This was back in the 60s, you know, the 1960s, not the 1860s. And it was the baby boom, like I said. There were like 100 people that hung out with me every day. We sat down in that park and we drank, and it was a jungle of malice every day. And this went on for a couple of years, and it was so much fun in the beginning. Relief, as they say in the big book, relief from care, boredom, and worry. You know, because I didn't care about anything anymore. And I certainly wasn't bored. And I wasn't worried about anything, because I always thought, what's the worst that could happen to me? I'll die. I was okay with that. And then after several years of drinking like this with all these dudes in the park, they started to die on me. And like 30 of them were dead before they were 22 years old. 30 out of that 100. That's pretty bad odds. My friend Richie died of cirrhosis of the liver at 20 years old. So we were going at it pretty hard. And then something happened. Some of these people I used to see every day, they stopped being there. And I'd run into them months later, and I'm like, where have you been? I haven't seen you down the park. And they'd say, I can't go down the park and drink every day, you know, the rest of my life. I said, why? What? You know, what else are you going to do? And they'd tell me, well, I'm going to college now, or I have a job now, or I'm getting married now. I'm having a baby now, you know. I thought, those poor losers, you know. I'm here free. And I could not see that I was only free within my cage, you know. And I built the cage around myself, one drink at a time. And so, you know, people went on having lives and stuff, and my life remained just the same from about the age of 12 years old. About the age of 36 years old. So I'm going to skip through a lot of that stuff and tell you, at 36, I had been drinking all that time, and I'd gone through the three phases of alcoholism, fun with problems, and then I was firmly entrenched in the problems section. And I had a successful business with my sister, and I was living in a cardboard box on a rooftop of a factory. An abandoned factory. And it was the winter time in New York City, which is not too tropical. It was freezing, and I'd get paid. I'd draw $600 cash out of that business on Friday night, and I'd say, this time it's going to be different. I'm going to stop at the bar. I'm going to get a couple of drinks, and then I'm going to go rent a room, you know? And on my way to the bar, I'd say, that's right. All I'm going to do is get a couple of shots and a couple of drinks, and maybe a little something else. And then I'm going to go get a room. And then the next thing the bartender is going, man, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. You know, it's closing time. And I'd look in my pocket, and that $600 was gone. Obviously, I'd been pickpocketed, you know. I pickpocketed myself and threw it on the bar. But I could not understand how that happened again. And again, and again, and again. And then at the very end, you know, I heard there was going to be a blizzard. And I knew I was going to freeze to death in that cardboard box. So I went and told my friend, who was also in his 30s and living in his mother's basement like we do. All us tough guys, you know. Mom. And he told me I could stay down in that basement. Well, I was down in that basement for 3 days, and I had a really nice leather coat, and I traded it away, full well knowing there's a blizzard coming. I traded it for money so I could get some more. And I'm down in this basement, and I'm drinking. And a fellow kicked in the door who had heard I was residing there. He and I had unresolved issues, as we would say, you know, in therapy and stuff. And he came in this door with a big, long butcher knife and proceeded to try to stab me to death. Now, let me rewind just a little bit. I've been down this basement for 3 days, There was no bathroom in this basement, and I could not leave to use the bathroom in the restaurant on the corner, because what if somebody came down with a bottle and I missed getting some? I lived in terror of that. And so I held it in. I held it in until this guy tried stabbing me to death. And then I found that you, most reluctantly, you cannot clench your sphincter muscle and defend yourself from a homicidal maniac at the same time. You must choose. Yeah, you must choose. One, because they both require all your attention at that point. And so this guy's stabbing away, and I had a 3-day fecal eruption in my trousers. Now, I'd been down this basement drinking for 3 days, looking at the pipes, wondering which ones would support my weight when I finally got up the nerve to hang myself. So I wasn't feeling too good anyway. I was kind of blue. And then when I did that 3-day eruption in my pants, it was like an anal Vesuvius. I mean, they were full. And I'm sorry to gross you out. But they were full. And I hit what was called in the book pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization right on the nose. And this guy's still stabbing away, and I got this flimsy coffee table between us I'm defending myself with. And finally he looked at me in disgust, and he said, "I'll kill you later." And he left. So my life was actually saved by feces. How many can say that? God works in mysterious ways. However, I didn't even realize that's why he left till I was coming to meetings for like 8 or 9 years. I told that story and somebody went, "Oh, well, yeah, you probably smelled awful after you did that." And I swear on all that is holy, I always started up because he just got tired. It never even occurred to me. That's my thinker. Yep. But, you know, once it was mentioned to me, I thought, that's probably true. But anyway, he said, "I'll kill you later," and he left. But he busted up this whole basement while he's down there. And Henry told me, "Man, you got a bad crowd. You're going to have to leave." And so he let me clean myself up the best I could in his aptly named slop sink. And loaned me a pair of jeans and kicked me out of that basement in a blizzard. Well, it might not have been a blizzard, but it was a snowstorm. It was about this deep. And he kicked me out in a short-sleeved shirt and a pair of borrowed jeans and a pair of white socks that were once white, but were now grayish. No, they were gray. They weren't grayish. And some sneakers. And out the door I went into the snow. And let me tell you, you know, it gets bite-ass cold in New York City in the winter. And it was that night. And I started to get hypothermic pretty quick. I put the hands in the pockets of the jeans, and there was a quarter in there. And I knew Henry didn't know that was in there, or he never would have loaned me those pants. I ran to a phone booth, and I stood there trying to think of some bridge I had not yet burned. And you know what? I stood there and stood there freezing, and I couldn't think of anybody that I was positive I could put this quarter in, and they wouldn't hang up on me. And so I said, "That's it, man. I had enough." So I put the quarter back in my pocket because I didn't want to be found dead without even a quarter in my pocket, you know. I have my image to think of. And I decided I'm going to go die. I'm going to go jump in front of the next subway train to pull into the station because this is horrible. I'm freezing. And I had to walk 3 blocks to the station in a straight line on the main street in my neighborhood. And I walked 2 blocks, and then I remembered the guy, Billy, telling me, "I'll kill you later." I said, "Shit, I've got to cut over a block. You know, get off the main street so I don't get killed on my way to kill myself." And I did. I cut over a block off the main street. And I'm walking down that block. And it sounds so dramatic because it is. But because of the storm, all the streetlights got knocked out. Boom. Just like that, plunged into darkness. The lights were still on in the houses and stuff. But the street was totally dark. And for just that moment, I started thinking of the finality of what I was about to do. Lights out, Dave. Lights out. Forever. And I looked up in the fallen snow. And I said, God, if you're listening, if you're out there anywhere and you have a better idea than what I'm about to do, now's the time. I'm all ears. And I took literally just a few more steps after I said that. And I was walking past this church hall, and the door opened, and a little baldy head popped out, and this guy started yelling at me, informing me I was in a snowstorm with no coat on, of which I was painfully aware, and trying to lure me into this building. And I'm thinking, who's this guy, you know? I'm freezing to death, like, you know, I have a lot of options, you know? But who's this guy? What does he want from me? As if I had anything for him to want from me. But the guy's begging me, please come inside. Please come in here with me. I'll give you a hot cup of coffee and a donut, he said. I said, oh, that sounds good. Then I can warm up. Then I only have a half a block to run to the station. I can make it there before I get too cold and jump. Great. My evening's all planned out. So he walks me in, he walks me down these steps, and he walks me into my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, November 20th, 1989. And it was this lady's 10th birthday that night. It was a big room. It was maybe just a tad bigger than this room. And I came in the door all the way in that corner, and she was all the way in this corner with her friends in this nice gown because she was getting taken to a Broadway show and dinner after the meeting by her husband. 10 years that night. Her friends are all around her giving her roses and cards and hugging her. And she's just smiling. And she looks across the room and saw me there. And she dropped her stuff on the floor, pushed her friends out of the way, and ran in high heels across this big room all the way to me and put her arms around me and said, welcome. Welcome, honey. I'm so glad you're here. You don't have to die. I was flabbergasted. How did she know? You know, how did she know? I know now how she knew. And I know now how Al, the guy that stuck his baldy head out the door upstairs, knew. Because only alcoholics have the eyes to see that desperate hollowness, that emptiness, that hopelessness for exactly what it is, to see it written on the face of another suffering drunk. And they saw it. She saw it all the way from across the room, this huge room, and ran to me. And, man, I was freezing. I mean, I stunk. Let me get that out of the way. I stunk so bad while I was frozen. As I began to defrost, that increased exponentially. I mean, that lady way back there, you would have had no trouble knowing I was in the room. None. And you know what? Nobody wrinkled their nose at me, and nobody said, man, that guy freaking stinks. And that lady Barbara, whose 10th birthday it was, she sat there next to me. She made her husband Mike give me his camel hair coat, which I stunk up. She made him go get me coffee. They let me eat all the donuts. Because as you know, I wasn't full anymore. You know, after my eruption. And she sat there with her arms around me, and I stunk so bad. I started crying. I said, lady, please let go of me. I'm going to ruin your dress. And she said, honey, I don't give a shit about my dress. I give a shit about you. And sat there and held on to me through that meeting. And that was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. Somebody told me, I don't care about this. It's a dress. You know, you're a person. One of God's children. You're worthy of being saved. Wow, I didn't feel that. But they told me, let us love you till you can love yourself. And then the meeting was over, everybody held hands, and we said a prayer, and I went for the door. And this guy answered, I said, where are you going? I told him, I don't know. He said, yeah, that's my point. You know, so they took me to this guy's house that night, this lady Pat's dad, and he washed my clothes for me. And he cooked me a meal. I let me sleep in a bed with a blanket. And in the morning he told me, oh, and I had asked the guy to be my sponsor at that first meeting because somebody suggested I do. And he said, if you stay sober for 24 hours, I'll be your sponsor. Meet me here tomorrow. And so I stayed at that guy Jack's house that night, and he told me, listen, I'm well connected around here. I can get you into detox, rehab, whatever you want. No problem. I said, nope. He goes, well, what are you going to do? I said, I just want to go back to those people I was with last night. And I walked the streets. He loaned me a coat, which was safe to do because I had taken a shower. He loaned me a coat, and I walked the streets up and down the blocks in New York all night till 7 o'clock, and I asked my sponsor, Jimmy, again to be my sponsor, and he said yes. And he took me by the hand and walked me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the 12 traditions, and I had to read the book. In the beginning, I had to read the book, and then it became, I wanted to read the book. But everything I read, I'd say, me too. Me too. I felt like that too. I've done that too. I read the story about the jaywalker. I was like, uh-huh. Yep. I identified with what I read in that book. And then I found out the second time I read it, they put all new stuff in there all the time. I started seeing all this stuff I just didn't see the other time. And you know, they still do that. You know, the 20th of last month, you know, with 19 years since walking down that snowy street and saying that prayer to a God that I wasn't very sure cared about me anymore. Because I certainly had stopped caring about him a long time before I had a new God came in a bottle. And in that time, you know, there's this one old jailbird, John C., got sober in Sing Sing, Sing Sing prison. He used to tell me, he said, keep coming back and don't drink in between meetings. Work the steps and your life is going to get better. And it's going to get better than that. Then it's going to get beyond your wildest dreams. And I thought, well, maybe for some people, but I'm too damaged. But that's just my alcoholic mind. My alcoholic mind still demands perfection of me, you know. Now I can tell it most of the time, thank you for sharing, thank you for sharing, you know. But it still demands that of me, you know. And I've been using the steps to become a new person over all these years, to become a different person than the one I was. Because they told me if I don't change the person that brought me in here, that person will bring me back out. You know, and I've known people with 40-something years to go out and relapse and die fast. Because this is a progressive disease. And they don't care that I'm stopped right now today. It's progressing even without me. I wouldn't pick up where I left off. I'd pick up where I would have been if I hadn't left off. That's how I believe. And if it's progressive, where did I end up, where did I stop? Like a half a block from the train station? That wouldn't be a very long party. You know? And so I come here and I still read the book. I still go to step meetings. And I still call my sponsor and something's bugging me, you know? And he always does the same thing. He pulls out a sheet of paper and pen. He says, let's do the steps on that right now. We'll sit there for 3 hours or 4 hours, but I walk out of there feeling free of that again. You know? It used to be if something bothered me, it bothered me for 20 years, 30 years. If it scabbed up, I ripped the scab off and let it bother me some more, you know? I learned how to not do that here. Today I have friends that care about me. You know? And I care about them. I was dead inside. I couldn't care about anybody, not even myself. You know, and I wanted to jump in front of that train, and I realized that I would have missed the best things in my life. You know? And I would have missed the best people in my life. And the best feelings in my life. And I would have missed being connected with a higher power that when this life is over, I feel confident that I'll be invited into another one that's pretty darn good. You know, not because of any great accomplishments of mine in sobriety, but just because my higher power loves me. You know, so I just want to leave you with a story real quick. There's a guy, I used to go to the Fence Retreat every year in Staten Island, and this guy Paul, he got sober in the Oxford group. He was like in his 90s. And knew Bill Wilson when Bill was still drinking, because they both worked on Wall Street. I mean, that's how long this guy's been sober. And he ran this retreat. And he was telling me one night about when he was in the Army in World War II. He was in the Army Corps of Engineers. And as the Germans were retreating before the Allied forces, they had the scorched earth policy, where they'd like burn all the fields and blow up the waterworks and the electrical works, so, you know, the incoming soldiers would have no amenities, you know, no running water, no lights and stuff. And the Army Corps of Engineers had to go in and get everything up and running again. And so he was in with these engineers, and they'd work all day. And the Nazis, before they left this one town they were in, they had the statue of Christ in the town square, and they blew it up just to be pricks, you know? They blew up the statue. And they said every night after work, all of us would get together, we gathered all the pieces, and we began to put the whole statue back together. And he said, we had the whole statue back together, except we hadn't done the hands yet. And we got the orders that we had to move on, you know, to the next town. And he said, we felt kind of bad, you know, that we didn't get to finish it. He said, but the next morning we got in the jeeps and we drove through the town square past the statue, and somebody had put a sign under it, said, he has no hands but yours. And if you get nothing else that you take from this pitch tonight, remember that God has chosen us from the great available pool of dysfunctional drunks, because he has no hands but ours, to reach out and say, hey, how you doing? I'm so-and-so. Welcome. Has no arms but ours to tell somebody, I don't give a shit about my dress. I give a shit about you. He has no mouth but ours to say those words. And he has no eyes but ours to see that hopeless desperation walking by and recognize it for what it is and invite them. Not beg, he begged me. He didn't invite me. He begged me to come into this way of life. Because he had been saved from a drunkard's death by this program. You know? Just like all of us have been saved from a horrible, horrible drunkard's death. So remember to be God's eyes and be God's hands and be God's ears when somebody has something they need to talk to you about, because it's easy after a while to go, man, in a hurry, you know? The Beverly Hillbillies Marathon is starting, you know? Never forget where you came from and you'll never have to go back. You know, always remember, like, we are each other's angels. Thank you. Merry Christmas. $1 million movie. Yeah, that was $1 million movie, and they actually showed the same movie twice a day. Once in the morning and once at night. So you could pass out like several times that week and still eventually see the whole film. I always thought that was handy too. Yes. Hi. Oh, me too. Thank you. How long did it take you to actually feel you were in that? took me until that woman said that sentence to me. I don't give a shit about my dress. I give a shit about you. That got me right in the heart. It really did. It still does. Always will. And I called her on November 20th to tell her, still here, Barb? She was like, yes, thank you, God. Yeah, that was her little project when I got started. She knew I had no money, so she said, oh, Dave, you know, can you come over and fix my screen door? I think she was going around her house purposely breaking stuff just so I could come fix it so she could give me money and I wouldn't feel like it was charity. Nobody has that much broken stuff, man. I guess I'd have to just say God did. You know, I got sober in New York City. I was there the first 2 years of my sobriety. I went from that cardboard box. Within a year and a half, I was living on 21st floor, two-bedroom apartment with a doorman down by the South Street Seaport with a river view from one balcony and the Twin Towers, boom, like right there outside my other balcony. And I was so comfortable there, and I pray and I meditate, and God just kept saying, time to move, time to go, time to go. And I wanted to ignore it so bad, but he just was very persistent. And so I packed up my car, and I drove around for 6 weeks. Just anywhere I wanted to go, I made meetings in every state except Alaska so far, because I haven't gotten up there yet. And after 6 weeks, I wound up in California, and up in Arcata, California, up in Humboldt County. And I stayed there for 12 years. And I was bitching about my job to my sponsor, and my sponsor said, I'm tired of you talking about the problem. What about the solution? Why don't you go, if you don't like your job, go to school and get a career. I said, I can't go to college for 4 years. He said, no, you can't, but today you can go register. And I went, oh, yeah, I could do that. And so I graduated in 96 as a registered nurse. I've been a registered nurse for about almost 13 years. Yeah. Most of that in mental health because, damn it, they are my people. All of them used to say to me, you know, the other nurses don't understand me like you do, Dave. I say, yeah, I know. And I 12-stepped a whole lot of people in that mental hospital that are still going to meetings and still sober. A whole lot. That's like 18 or so. To me, that's a whole lot. That stayed sober. You know? That's a wonderful gift. Now, you know, I remember reading in the Bible one time, you know, God saying, I'm going to give my chosen people the power to heal through me. You know, that's what we do, isn't it? You know, we do our higher power's will, you know, and touch people, let God touch people through us. You know, it's not me, or I'd be like, hip hip hooray, you know, look at me. But, you know, congratulating an alcoholic for staying sober is like congratulating a cowboy with hemorrhoids for not riding his horse. You know, we only do it because it hurts too much when we drink, you know? But, you know, it's not how much time you have sober. It's what you do with your time sober. I know a lot of people with 25 years, they don't have time for people, you know? He said, oh, no, don't ask me this question. Ask him over there. You know? I don't ever want to be that. I don't ever want to be that because I know how scared I was when I asked my sponsor to be my sponsor. What if he says no? I've been rejected all my life. You know? I was ready to hear some yeses. You know? And so... How does this program work? It works real good. Keep coming back.
Well, I have a question for you, Dave.
Yes.
You place a lot of emphasis in your talk about working the steps. Have you, or do you recommend that people take the steps more than one time?
Every time something is really starting to bother me, I go to my sponsor and we work the 12 steps on that problem. I mean, I do that all the time. I'm surprised he's not sick of me. But I guess he's not. He tells me, he says, well, thanks for keeping me sober. And isn't that really the bottom line? We think we're helping them, but who's really taking out the insurance policy on their sobriety? That's us. You know? We can't keep it unless we give it away. Oh, one other thing I want to tell you, because it's kind of funny. I'm going to get married May 2nd, you know, which is amazing in itself. I was not marriage material. No. Unless, like, I met you in the bowling alley bar and you had, like, three teeth or something. I was not marriage material. And just like the other day, these people called me from Yuba City and they said, you know, we heard one of your CDs from the Rogue River Roundup up in Oregon. And they said, and, you know, we want to have you come up and speak at our Roundup in Yuba City this spring. And I said, I'd be happy to. I'd be honored to. And they said, I'll do it. Just call me and tell me when, you know. So they called me the other day and they said, oh, we got the date for you. I said, okay, what is it? I'll write it down. They said, it's May 1st. I said, wow, I'm getting married the next day. I better ask her. So I went and talked to my fiance and said, yeah, they asked me to go to Yuba City and speak on the 1st and then, you know, I'll go up there and then I'll drive like hell and come back and we'll get married. He's like, wow, you're willing to go to any lengths, aren't you? I said, we wouldn't be getting married if it wasn't for this program. So she said, you go and have a good time. I'm getting my hair done. So that's kind of interesting. That should make for a funny talk, you know. Yeah, I'll try and wrap this up quick. I got to go get married now.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Thank you.